And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast live from Cleveland, Ohio, where I just could not be more excited, as always, to be joined by the one and only, soon-to-be Hall of Famer, still the all-time assist leader, I believe, for women's basketball. No?
No.
Oh, my God.
I've been out of the all-time assist leader at Providence College. There's a wonderful short little guard, 5'2", Shania Evans. She was up and actually won. You know how they have the award in men's college basketball, 6 feet and under?
Yeah.
They have a similar one for women's basketball, and Shania Evans won it as a senior. She was just a dynamic speedster point guard, and I still am mad at Shania for beating my Providence College.
If you haven't guessed, it's Doris Burke, literally the one and only. And I'll tell you, Shania Evans, that's her name?
Shania Evans.
She's an enemy of this podcast.
She should be.
An enemy of the podcast. Doris, first of all, it's public knowledge. We announced it. Congratulations. You signed a new deal with ESPN.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really excited, Zach. You know, I love the game, and to do it for a little bit more time is really exciting for me. I'm very, very happy.
One of the things I like about you, among very many, is that no matter how successful you get, there was a small part of you that was worried about your contract negotiations. Not worried, like, necessarily. It wasn't all like, oh, my gosh, where am I going to be? There was a lot of pride in what you deserved, but there was also like you're not satisfied or assuming that this goes on forever, and there's a certain humility and sort of work ethic to that. Is that fair to say? Am I characterizing you correctly?
I am a worrier by nature. I can invent things to make myself nervous about. My children would concur with that, and then the other part of it is, yes, you know, this is a very. Listen, as you know, there's not a single person probably in any profession who's not replaceable, not one of us. And you could be talking about the same announcer or in a room hearing people discussing an announcer and have opinions so disparate from one another. So, yeah, I don't take it for granted, and I was very nervous, and it really has to do with my insecurities more than it does anything else, and that's okay.
It's crazy. You're Doris Burke. That's what everyone would say. You're Doris Burke. What do you have to be insecure about? Just as I walked in from walked into the studio, I walk into a scene of someone at ESPN Cleveland getting you to record a friendly message for a fan. This is just what happens to you now. It's just like I go out of the room for 5 minutes. Someone is asking you, my friend's a big fan, can you record something? You're probably somebody's outgoing voicemail.
As you know, that hasn't always been the case. And so it's sort of been the shift. And I can't quantify it. I couldn't tell you when it happened. I think there are probably many things that have contributed to it. Most notably, I've been around so long, I think I've just worn people out. They have no choice. But, yeah, hey, listen, the deal is done. I'm excited. And, listen, I know Cleveland's down 0-2, Zach, but I'm excited to see what happens tomorrow. I have a hard time believing that LeBron doesn't have more fight in him.
Where does game one rank in your all-time just sort of I'm glad I was there games?
Wow. Yeah. I've said this many times. LeBron has provided me so many incredible moments in my career. And I was just talking about the shift in attitude toward me. And I know we're going to talk basketball, but I would say this to you. Like, it's a very powerful thing when the best players in the world react to me in a certain way on television. And the conversations I've had with LeBron, the fact that he looks me eye to eye, the fact that he pauses to consider my question, I think has a profound effect on those viewers watching, and maybe other NBA players. And so I think he takes me seriously as a basketball person. I don't think he does it because he thinks he's changing minds, but I do think that he and Steph and Kevin and all these guys, because of their interactions with me, it's not even in their consciousness, but I know it has some effect. Where does that game rank? I mean, just to watch the 51-8-8 on the road, and perhaps with Houston coming off a 7-game series, where to a man, before game one, when we sat with Steph and Clay and KD, and all three men in an interview on camera admitted to feeling stress, pressure, and anxiety. And the Warriors, for stretches this season, have not looked very Warrior-like. And Steve Kerr has been grasping and pulling and trying to find all the right notes and chords to play with his team. if the Cavaliers could have won that game, if the call is not overturned, and listen, I said this in a group too, I spoke to the Warriors staff, like the Cavaliers, and it's not like Golden State has never suffered from this, but in game one, the Cavaliers had a very tough whistle. Then you had the missed free throw, and then you had the JR brain freeze. So my point, that was a long-winded way of saying, where would we be? How different would the tone and tenor of this series be had all that not transpired? LeBron puts him in position to win with 51-8-8. It's this majestic, king-like performance, and those men who all admitted to feeling pressure and have to play every single night and be the shot makers and bad men that they are. Man, could you imagine?
It was a majestic performance. I called it magisterial in my column. I don't even know if that's a word, but they let it slide. It was like he was so much better than everyone else on the floor, including two of the top five players in the NBA, other than him.
Think about it. At the end of last season's series, we are talking about, and Kevin Durant believed, and I think rightly so, after what we witnessed from Kevin Durant last year, he had closed the gap. He sat in that taxi cab with Carrie Champion and basically said, I'm 1B, baby. And that line about, you know, I feel like that was LeBron passing the torch to me. Come on, he had closed that gap. And now all of a sudden that gap feels wider again, doesn't it?
We're all wrong all the time. One of the things I'm happy that I'm right about was as that discussion was going on in a column somewhere during that series, I wrote something like, can we hit the brakes on, right, like, is Kevin Durant the best player in the NBA debate? Because he's not, and it's not close. Like, this season and this series has reminded everyone, like, it's not close. That dude just keeps getting better. Yeah. LeBron keeps getting better. To hang 51, like, effortlessly. Like, it was just effortless. It was outrageous, and it felt like a game they had to get. Where were you when the JR thing happened? I rewatched it so many times. You're there, right? You're.
I'm sitting.
You know what I should have done?
Steps away from him dribbling, basically right at me.
I should have looked. I watched the play a million times, in part because I wanted to text whoever on the Warriors bench. Mm-hmm. I thought had the funniest reaction. I was going to anoint that person and I did text that. It was a coach who I thought had the funniest reaction. So I watched all of them. I didn't watch you. What would I have seen? Have you watched yourself? Are you just astonished like everybody else?
But it's interesting you say that. And first of all, sometimes I can be thirsty for interaction on the sideline, Zach. And by that I mean, if I'm in the analyst chair, I am, you know, because the role is so different, you're fully engaged. You're talking play by play. And but on sideline, I'm having sort of visceral reactions. So when Kevin Durant walked up into that three last year with the game hanging in the balance and shot that basketball in LeBron's face, I think I tossed my hands in the air and like, you have got to be blanking kidding me. And I had a moment the other day when it was the open floor play. LeBron has possession. He gets tripped up, but there's no foul called.
Right.
Okay. And I put my hands in the air like, wow, no call there. Now, I'm not rooting either way. Just like I had the reaction in game six to Kevin Durant a season ago, I had the reaction like, whoa, I'm surprised there wasn't a call there. I'm not rooting, but I am invested in the game. And sometimes I'm hitting the talk back button to my producer, Tim Corrigan, and I might be a stream of profanity. Like, I cannot believe he just made that shot.
I can't believe you just beeped yourself. You were like, no blanking. I'm like, no. Doris, I know, would curse.
Right.
And referred to herself as the B word as a basketball player on this podcast a year ago, said that's how I played.
Yes.
So I believe that.
Yeah.
So JR dribbled right at you.
I don't know. You know, that's a great question. I remember my eyes were probably like, what is going on? And then I'll say this to you, like, you know, at the end of regulation, I've got to go to the Cavaliers huddle, and I am sitting on if LeBron's sitting in the last chair on the right as he always does, I'm at his right shoulder. And usually Allie Clifton, the sideline reporter for the Cavs, and then Ramona, who's doing sideline for ESPN Radio, all three of us are watching what's transpiring. And it was just so fascinating because I know they released the footage and you see the 3-plus minute clip and LeBron taking some heat today. It felt like initially he was pretty stoic in there. And then there were some reactions, obviously, you know, the recognizing the no timeout. Sometimes, Zach, do you ever think about the fact that these men, these coaches, and these officials play their life out in such incredible scrutiny on a daily basis? And the performance pressure that they feel every single day, and the glare and the weight of that. They are handsomely paid, but it's incredible to me. I do feel we live in an era like Big Brother is watching, and it's just a matter of time for all of us to have a moment where we don't look great.
Like a Brian Colangelo moment right
yeah,
now. I mean,
right,
we're
exactly.
all one mistake away.
Yeah.
I've been running around to so many things today. Like, I haven't been on social media. I sound like LeBron. I haven't been on social media. He's taking heat for what? For not knowing the timeout situation or for his conduct?
So consider this where, you know, you have the prescribed interview times for today, and ESPN always has its room because we're talking to specific players and we're trying to capture sound and get to certain storylines, but see what's, you know, Mike Breen is a tremendous, you know, he's tremendous with these players asking questions and trying to get at the heart of what we're trying to cover. And while we're waiting in between the Cavaliers who went first and the Golden State Warrior players then coming in, there was a clip of LeBron's press conference. And apparently there is now a full 3-plus minute clip of the entirety of the Cavaliers bench between the end of regulation in game one and then the start of the overtime. And I believe the questioner said something like, hey, there's this clip of you out there, LeBron, and you're taking some criticism for not encouraging your teammates or something. I don't want to get the wording incorrect. People would be able to go access the clip. You know, people are criticizing you for not being supportive of your teammates in that interim between.
Sure.
And his response was exactly before he got to his answer, I was thinking to myself, well, I think he's pretty much helped his team get here and put him in a position to win game one. So I get that you could, you know, I did think his reactions in the huddle were powerful enough that, and especially I find this true of the new guys. And I said this to Kyle Korver today in our interview, Zach. When I am watching the game or when I am watching their huddle, I can't take my eyes off him. Like, he is that powerful a presence. And I think, and Doc Rivers talks all the time about the power of nonverbal communication, your body language as a basketball player. Well, who holds more power in the palm of his hands, especially with certain new teammates like George Hill? Like, I saw George Hill. I remember saying this to Brian Windhorst before this footage aired, right after game one, or maybe the next morning. I just said, you know, there was a moment where at first he's sitting calmly, and then I think he feels the weight of what just happened, and he is human as much as we all think he's Superman. You could see there was a moment where LeBron felt the weight of everything that had transpired, not just the overturned call, you know, a couple of clean strips by them that they don't get, and then
sure,
whatever the 2-minute report said about Draymond, et cetera, we've rehashed it ad nauseum. But he had a human reaction, and I wonder, and I can't quantify it, but I remember George Hill sitting with his head in a towel with his hands down. Now, you imagine that. You could have, you tied the game, first of all, make the first shot, probably the tougher of the two. You make the first free throw, but then you miss the second. So the weight of that is on your shoulders. And at first LeBron's looking straight ahead, and then he you can see him ask Ty Lue, we didn't have a timeout, and the obvious reaction to that. But there was a moment where I saw George Hill sort of glance, and you'll see this in the footage, he just side-eyed LeBron, like, how's my man reacting over there? Are we all
right? Then, and maybe it was around that time, but I do remember around the time where LeBron reacts about the timeout and slumps in his chair,
mm-hmm.
JR and I think Tristan kind of tap George Hill on the knee as if to say, hey, it's all right, man. We missed free throws. You know, everyone missed. It's okay.
Correct.
And huddles are weird things. We have this sense that huddles should be constant communication and lifting each other up. And like what happened in that huddle, you know, it's not like I watched them all. You watch a lot. It didn't seem unusual to me. And even the coaches, like people are starting to realize now because you see it in the backgrounds of the coach interviews. Mm-hmm. They all just walk out into the middle of the court and talk to each other for like 90 seconds and then go in, and it's not this big, everyone's yapping at each other, discussing the X's and O's and the strategy. Like, sometimes it's just a bunch of dudes waiting for the commercial to end.
That's exactly right. And I'll tell you how long they are, because we had to start this is in the Eastern Conference Finals, late. It might have been five or six in the Eastern Conference Finals, and I had to restart an interview. It very rarely happens. I think our cameraman had gotten bumped as I go to start to interview Brad, and my director says, "Stars, we got to start again." And that's unusual.
Oof.
You know me, I don't want to.
No.
We don't, you just, I'm asking one question typically in the finals because this is the situation we're in. But I say to Brad Stevens, you know, I just basically stop, restart, and the next day when we see him at media, I said, "I am so sorry for having to start again." He goes, "Please, those timeouts are so long." They're long, and you're right. And I'll be honest with you. When I move to this position, and this is why, whether I'm the analyst or the sideline, if I know the local announcers, I'm talking to them as an analyst because they're in the minutia of the team every day. And
sure.
There's times I'm going to Allie Clifton and I'm saying, is this a typical interaction? Is that typical? Is this what he does? Is this what that?
And especially Allie has really earned the trust of those players.
Oh, my God.
She knows them well.
No doubt. And so I have to depend on her. And she's like, "Oh, yeah, this happens all the time." But you're right. It's not what you think happens. They're long. And those coaches stand out there because they're like, "I'm not talking for 4 minutes or whatever it is."
Well, and also the players, like, I looked at that clip and just thought, well, of course they're shell-shocked.
Yes.
Look what just happened to them.
Right.
And they know, man, we got to go 5 more minutes with this team. And you know an eruption is coming. You give them enough time, you know an eruption is coming.
Mm-hmm.
And LeBron knows that Cleveland isn't as good as Golden State. He knows. He's smarter than all of us about basketball.
Correct.
He knows that when you get that close on the road, you gotta get it. You just gotta get it to have a chance to win the series.
You win that game and all you gotta do is win your home games.
Yeah.
You've done the single most difficult thing and you did it in game one.
And to be heartbroken, I get what people are saying about players are going to take their cue from him. He is the alpha of the NBA. I mean, I know. For everything. I mean, I know it seems like 5 years ago, but when the league was worried and embroiled in a sort of preemptive controversy about what's going to happen if somebody kneels for the anthem at the beginning of the season, and we have this rule on the books that you have to stand for it, they were very relieved when LeBron came out and said, "I'm going to stand. You know, I make my my social conscience is directed in other ways, off the court and all this stuff." Everyone in the league office was like, "Phew," because everyone else is going to listen to LeBron. Whatever LeBron does, everyone else is going to do.
Yeah.
So maybe he could be more supportive, but I saw a team that was collectively but I mean, like, it's not like J.R. Smith is sitting there showing contrition and apologizing, and he's just sitting stone cold silent too. Listeners, you know I like any product that saves me time, and I've never actually been in a position where I could hire someone, but I can't imagine the exercise of sifting through a gazillion applications, wondering, did I post my job on the right job site? Oh my gosh, there are 4,000 job sites. This is going to become an ordeal. ZipRecruiter is a smarter, faster way to do all of that. It saves time for employers. It builds a platform where they can find you or you can find them. It's very easy. ZipRecruiter learns what an employer is looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and literally proactively invites them to apply for your job. 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter even highlights the strongest applications for the job so that you never miss a great match. They literally send them to here are the, hey, these ones might be better than the rest. Take a look at these. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter helps you find them. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right. Free. It literally doesn't get any cheaper unless they start paying you, which I don't think ZipRecruiter is going to do, so you'll have to settle for free. All you have to do is go to ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, the name of this podcast, L-O-W-E, post. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. Have you ever seen stuff in a huddle where you knew, I can't say that on television, what I just saw I can't ever say on television, or have you ever been looking at a huddle from your vantage point so close and had someone from a team say, this is, you can't be here right now. Like this is too serious of a situation.
All right. No, it's funny. They're now used to it, but I know this, and it's been a bit since I've had Rick Carlisle as a sideline reporter. I try really hard not to be within direct eyesight. In the past, I've tried not to be in direct eyesight of the head coach. I just wouldn't want to do that. But when I first started, I didn't know that, and so I'm in the direct viewing line of Rick Carlisle, and Rick is delightful to me and couldn't be more supportive, but he just basically goes, get out of there. And I laughed, and it wasn't even that tense a moment. It was just like, get out of there. This is my space. But have I ever not said anything on TV? You know what, Zach? It's going to have to be, because generally speaking, I'm sidelined on Jeff, Mark, and Mike's team.
Yeah.
And I just find what they say is so important and so compelling. And I have beliefs about the sideline role. Like, I don't want to be talking over live action. It's got to be so good for me to be in live action, because I don't think the viewer needs that kind of clutter. And I'm in no way diminishing the role I have. I'm just saying to you, there's certain things mechanically I believe are correct and incorrect about the position. But I would say I would be careful. I'm never going to talk strategy.
Right.
Because it's just inappropriate.
Is that unspoken or is that explicit?
No, I would assume that's pretty explicit, because, okay, you know, we can't run wired of,
sure,
of a strategy. But it would have to be pretty compelling, particularly in the Eastern Finals or West Finals or the Finals.
I mean, I remember Stephanie Reddy, who was sidelined for Charlotte and was in an analyst role last season. They would give her, like, she would report out of the huddles, like, this is what they're going to run on this play. And I think it's because Charlotte was like, yeah, we don't care, like, whatever. Just, they clearly gave her a carte blanche where the Charlotte Hornets doesn't matter. No one is going to be watching, you know, to relay to the other team what's going to happen.
I've always thought this, like, and it's not going to happen on the NBA level. Like, if what the announcers are saying, unless it's maybe Jeff or Mark or somebody's, like, I don't know, these guys are just, their minds are so sophisticated. They have access to so much information. Like, some of the paranoia may be overdone, but I just think there's certain things that there's a time and a place.
Agreed.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about the series, I promise, but now we've gotten on tangents that are too interesting for me. When I watch anyone who's on sideline, and by the way, I want like 900% more of Doris Burke in analyst role than we get now. Can I ask you? You're not going to be able to comment. Does your contract have a number?
No number on either. I mean, oh yeah, just certain number of events per year.
Like, are we going to get more Doris Burke in an analyst role?
I would say, you know, what you saw this year would be very standard and typical for me. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I want more.
Well, we only have like 100 games or something, and we have tremendous analysts, obviously. You know, the men I work with, Hubie Brown, we've got tremendous analysts.
Okay,
as many games as you think are on ESPN. What are they total? Like, I don't even know. Maybe 100 before the playoffs. I'm not sure what that number is. But I have to say I'm having an absolute blast doing it. Blast.
Well, you're amazing at it, so we all have a blast listening to it. But the moment where I am most vicariously nervous for you is not Pop in the coach's interview, because that's all old hat now. Like, it's going to get uncomfortable, but everyone, and by the way, everyone sympathizes with you now. It's not even funny anymore.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a cool meme anymore. It's just whatever. Is when something like Klay Thompson goes down in the first quarter of whatever it was in game one, that's it now. You've got to go get that. Mm-hmm. And diligent as you are, you want to give us the story.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the team is not going to know the story. Like, this injury just happened. We have no news for you to report, or they're not going to give you the real story because it's a competitive situation. Because I can feel, I know that you probably want to right away give us the real story, the real truth. Like, is that as nerve wracking? Do I not need to be so vicariously nervous for you?
No, I would say, the coaches' interviews, still all of them, make me not nervous, but I try to get decent content, but I'm also trying to understand the situation.
And by the way, Brad's got to be top five best coaches to have that screw up happen with
in the
NBA,
right? Oh, yeah, no question about it. Yeah, no question. But the injury situation, I'll give you an example. So I had a couple of situations as the playoffs wore on with Cleveland, and for some reason, instead of running into the PR director first, I'm running into Kobe Altman.
Mm-hmm.
And Kobe was nice enough to give me the information. And then on the play where Kevin, my first thought was, oh, my God, that's a concussion. And Kobe kind of brushed by me, and he wouldn't say anything. And I'm like, okay, I know what's going on in Kobe Altman's mind. He would want to tell me. But in this instance, he's got to be hyper-vigilant about what it is the Cavaliers say.
Sure. If he says the C-word, then they're bing, under scrutiny immediately.
Bing, bing, bing. And the other thing is never speculate. What I can do, there's a difference between speculation and observation. So we're always taught on the broadcast, never speculate. You might think, I remember watching Mark Jones. Was it Kobe? No, it was the DeMarcus Cousins game this year. So I'm watching Mark Jones, who is a tremendous, for people who don't know, he was a tremendously successful basketball player in Canada. And Zach, he basically knew that Boogie had blown his Achilles. And he could not speculate, but he basically, through the power of observation, said, if you've seen somebody blow their Achilles, I'm not saying this is what he did, but it certainly looks like that. And so I'll tell you this. There was the game in the finals where I think it was the finals, maybe it's the West Finals, where Steph Curry took the fall, and they're on the road, and I see them sort of doing an eye test with Steph Curry through a crack in the door that just happened to be open as I'm coming by. Now, I can report that.
Sure. You saw it.
Right. So it's observational as opposed to speculation. For me, it's always about, is this worthy? Should I say it? I would say you're 100% correct. Those are anxiety producing. I'll tell you one that drove me crazy.
Ooh, now I'm excited.
Yeah. And it caused, you know, some consternation with me and our group. And then we were in San Antonio on the great air conditioning blowout game.
Mm-hmm. I was not at that game.
And trying to get information as a sideline reporter from the building or, you know, San Antonio, who was obviously the home team, was very difficult. And it was difficult, I think, in essence, because they were trying to figure it out at first. So I switched paths, and I downloaded a temperature gauge onto my phone and tried to see, could I measure the temperature on the interior of the building? Like, you know, you're trying to zig and zag as a sideline reporter to figure out, okay, I can't get information from over here. And then it led to dialogue with the league afterwards saying, listen, I'm not trying to break news here. Everybody in America, the people in this building are feeling the heat, and everybody in America is watching. Communication would be nice to our fans. What is happening in the building? And so that was one that I'll never forget.
When did you – obviously, you played at a high level in college. You wanted to stay around the game, whether it was coach, broadcast, and I believe – I've read your backstory so many times, I'm going to forget the details wrong, but there was a radio broadcast you got thrown into kind of last minute that triggered a lot of this, I think.
It was Providence College Women's Basketball. I left because I was getting married. And I get married, and I can't remember. I may have been pregnant with my first child, and they put Providence College Women's Basketball on radio, Zach. And honest to God, thank God it was radio, because if they ever put a red light in front of my face, I would have froze.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Did you know... like, I'm a good talker. Did you already know, like, the talking about the game is something I can do? Or did you ever think, like, writing about the game might be something I can
Never.
Do? Like
so. Not in a million years. I thought I would be a high school teacher and coach. That's a God's honest truth.
I thought
after, even when once I got married and I left coaching, and that was a very tough decision for me. I loved coaching, Zach. I loved it. But I wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and I thought at that time those ideas were mutually exclusive. So picture that's hard for me. And I thought, and I ended up going back, and I got my master's while I was pregnant with Sarah, and I have my master's in education. And I thought I would teach and coach a high school team, but literally the year I left coaching, they put Providence on women's basketball and radio, and I happened into it that way. And every single year from that point forward, it's grown step by step, and that was... I left coaching in 1990.
People think the talking part is easy.
No, the basketball part was easy for me.
Right.
The TV communications piece, I didn't know what camera to look at. I didn't know when it was appropriate for me to talk or not talk. I knew none of it.
Oh, just how to talk and how to be engaging. Like the guy I always use that as an example because he's almost, punchline is too strong. I just think, like, people look at Ryan Seacrest and they're like, Ryan Seacrest is everywhere. Like, that dude is so talented. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, what that guy can do in any situation.
Yeah.
To be that smooth and that compelling and that engaged, it's ridiculous. And so you get out there, like, you're talking about basketball on the air. So you had no inclination at that point, like, I might be, my voice, my cadence, my
Hell
ability.
No.
So no inclination at all.
None. All I know is I remember getting off the air and, one of our close friends was a longtime broadcaster, you know, sportscaster for a local radio station and then did play by play for virtually every team in the state of Rhode Island and still the URI announcer. He said, "You were really good at that." And I'm like, "Really?" And he said, "Yes, you were very good." And he's the guy who helped me. His name is Steve McDonald. He's the guy who helped me, you know, put the game board together and this is how you do it and this is how you prep and that sort of thing. And so the basketball, you know, part was the easiest part. It was the mechanics. I wasn't a communications major. I was someone who would be terrified normally when you see the red light come on. And so all that took time to get used to.
All right, guys, there is a huge difference between an off-the-rack suit and a made-to-measure suit. There is literally no comparison. A made-to-measure suit takes more time. It takes more effort. Sometimes it takes more money, but it is worth it. And Indochino, the world's largest made-to-measure menswear company, is here to shrink that time, money, effort gap and make a made-to-measure suit easier for you to do. They also do shirts, by the way. They'll measure every part of your body. They'll do everything. You can either go into a showroom or you can do it online, but they'll measure everything and they'll let you pick from a selection of high-quality fabrics and patterns and personalize every detail of a suit, the lapel, the lining, throw a monogram on there. You can go to a showroom, like the old-fashioned way, or you can go to Indochino.com and pick everything, submit your measurements, and then a custom suit will arrive literally at your house. And this week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $379, which is ridiculous. A made-to-measure suit can cost you $1,000-plus easily. All you have to do is go to Indochino.com and enter Lowe, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast, at checkout. That's at least 50% off the regular price of a made-to-measure premium suit. And shipping is free. Go to Indochino.com, promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E. And again, $379 with free shipping. How can the Cavs get back in this series? And more to the point, they clearly made a decision halfway through game one. So we're just going to switch everything. We're going to switch everything. We're going to switch Kevin Love onto Curry. We're just going to live with the consequences. Keep it simple. Switch everything. And Curry torched them. Torch Kevin Love. Torch Larry Nance. You know, the Warriors are scoring 124 points per 100 possessions, which is just astronomical.
It's ridiculous.
You need to hold them. Now, they're a great offensive team. You need to hold them to, like, at least their average to have any chance.
Right. About this, Zach. And this shocked me when I looked at the numbers. So if they're attacking Kevin Love, I think the number was 32 times. They switched it 22 times, right? But if you look at the points they scored in those pick and rolls where they attacked Love, in game one, I think it was 1.27 or maybe it was even higher than that per possession in those. It dropped.
It was modest in game two. It was like 1.1 or something.
It was modest in game two. The one thing I would say is, first of all, the Warriors, because they have so much shot making, and the idea that one of their highest intellect players is now about to come into the game, and so now maybe they don't have two non-shooters on the floor. I'm talking about Andre Iguodala. You know, they have so much shot making and so much playmaking that they don't ever afford for you an opportunity to relax. So I was watching those 32 times where they're attacking Kevin Love. And the number did drop precipitously, and I would bet that they're going to have to be incredibly decisive at the point of attack of that screen. You know how coaches say early, loud, and continuous, and they're talking about communication on pick and rolls. And if you're switching, you know, the first play of the game was the slip by JaVale McGee, dunk. Like, it's got everything, the two men involved in the screen, If you're the guy that's defending the screener, you've got to be physical and get him pushing into that screen. If they're going to the screen, you better, you know, be talking and be pushing into it and be aggressive at the point of attack. That's the first thing you've got to do. And then, you know, you look at some of the rotations, because what has Golden State preached and preached and preached in this? They have preached, make the next play. Look at the drastic difference in games for Kevin Durant and his efficiency game one to game two, and the higher number of assists. If the Warriors just continue to get to the next play, and if Andre Iguodala is back and as steady as Sean Livingston is, they're always going to get to that next play. Why do you think they were the monumental favorites coming into this? Because they have so much shot making and playmaking. Is Cleveland as comfortable as they've ever been? And maybe the four or five matchup, are they playing at times two non-shooters, Golden State? Yes. They've still got three of the baddest men on the planet when it comes to shot making. Shoot, you had a less than 100% Klay Thompson, and he comes out blazing in game two.
Klay's incredible. Klay's, how can you not love Klay? No one doubted he would play. Everyone's like, Klay will play. Maybe he'll be a little bit. Clay's an Iron Man. He'll never. It's.
What do you think? By the way, what do you think they should do defensively?
Well, I think Kevin Love has been fine on defense now for two finals in a row. Fine by his standards.
Right.
Like, he's not going to stop Steph Curry. He blocked him at the rim at one point in game two.
It's actually a couple of occasions, because I've got the 32 on my phone. There's a couple of occasions where he's down in the stance, he's stringing Curry parallel, or, as you say, that one where he's contesting him at the rim.
He's been adequate. Like, he isn't the reason why they're struggling defensively. He's not helping just because of the limitations of his feet and his speed and his verticality. Like, he's just...
But don't you need him, Zach? He's your next best option, shooting.
This is what I'm going to say. Like, the idea that the solution is to play Kevin Love less is crazy.
It's
because
ridiculous.
They are not... Their backup is Jeff Green, who's not as good. And it's... Jeff Green is more mobile. I get it. He's quicker. He's not a good defensive player. It's not like you have... Tony Allen coming off the bench or something, like, where you're just going to live with his limitations on offense because he is actually going to lock down someone on the other team.
But that's a player who can be maddening to me, because Jeff Green, because of the way he played in game one, helped them to be in a position to be there. And then the story of his career, as badly as he wants it, as much of a professional as he is, you didn't feel him for long stretches in game two. And that, to me... If you just listen to coaches over the years, what's the one thing they value as much as any, aside from talent, obviously? Like, consistency. What if I look at this player and I know this is what I can get from him on a night-by-night basis, as opposed to, say, a JaVale McGee, who sometimes I get the feeling with Coach Kerr, it's, I'm going to play him. I'm going to know almost immediately, is this going to be a good night or a bad night? And then I can move on accordingly. But there's certain, that's still, I can read what's happening. Where I don't think with Cleveland, you could go down and say, I know definitively tonight I'm getting X.
We just did the jump with Terry Rozier, and I told him this, and I wrote it. Like, the amazing thing about the Celtics was that they had no such players. None. Even the teams playing now, as you said, have even the Warriors have guys where you're like,
Jordan Bell.
Even Andre. Like, is Andre going to shoot tonight?
Right.
Is Andre going to just pass up every open three? Is he, you know, you just have guys, and like, the Celtics had nobody like that. Everybody was ready for them. Now, they may miss shots, like they missed 9,000 shots in game seven, but they're going to take them. They're going to take them when they should. They have the courage to take them.
I have a question for you, because you just sprung an idea. And I've heard Jeff Van Gundy reference this on multiple occasions, and it's just because you said the Celtics, who seem to have built their roster around what works in today's NBA, long athletic wings, great switchability. Okay, so we are in an era where there's so much switching in the NBA. What does that mean? What's the next thing you value in an offensive player? Like Jeff keeps saying, you're going to need people who can put it on the deck and get by and make the next play. And so is that the next great thing of value in the NBA? I don't know. Because I heard somebody say something you know, how do the Warriors play next year? How do they look? What's different? Is it the same ethos? I don't know. I just, it's an ongoing evolution in the NBA. Like this morning at our meeting, Mike Breen kept asking the respective players, particularly shooters or defensive players like George Hill, we're in a different era. Like George Hill said, we've always been taught defend from the paint out. It was like George Hill still reluctantly wants to guard the three first.
Right.
Because it's been pounded into his life. Who said today, over half my career? Oh, Kyle Korver. Kyle Korver says today, over half my career we spent in the NBA looking for efficient twos.
Well, he's told me a story. I wrote a big profile of Kyle 5 years ago or 4 years ago. He told me a story. When he got to the NBA, I'm going to mess up who the coaches were, but his first coach, I want to say it was Randy Ayers maybe, didn't want him taking threes. Like he wanted him to step in. And so then I believe the order of events is then they hired Jim O'Brien. And at one of the first practices Kyle has, he catches the ball from Iverson on a fast break and instead of taking a three, dribbles in, shoots a 16-footer, makes it, and is like strutting a little bit like it's a great moment for me. And Jim O'Brien stops practice and says, if you ever f***ing take a two again when you are open for three, I'm taking you out of the game. Take the three.
Wow.
And Kyle, who's getting yelled at, screamed at, cursed at, remembers thinking in his head, oh, now this is fun. Now I've got a coach that's good for me.
I do think they need to find a way to pop him open.
But the Warriors are he's never gotten off against the Warriors. They are the best guarding Kyle Korver team that I've ever seen.
And they're just switching. And like one of the things we talked to him about was what happens to players when you switch? You're just hunting the matchups now, right? And this goes to when the Spurs won their championship and Jeff is on the air saying, this is the most beautiful basketball I've ever seen. The Warriors win their championship and it is absolutely stunning to watch. But now you're going back to what we saw with James Harden, Chris Paul. And is that the next evolution? And then this, where both teams are hunting those matchups, you're pounding the matchup and everybody else on the other side is just standing and stagnant. And if you're Kyle Korver, you can't function in a world that's stagnant.
Well, and you know, this is going to sound ridiculous, but you know, we all remember that Spurs championship in 2014 is like the most beautiful basketball. One of the reasons Boris Diaw was valuable to their team was when they faced a defense that would switch a little bit, he could kick butt in the post. You could give it to him on a small guy and he could actually create something in the post. Like that's one of the reasons they got Boris. And I do think, and I know people in the league office are grappling with the idea that we spent the entire season anticipating Houston Golden State, in part because we knew Houston's going to switch everything. That's the strategy they've been preparing for Golden State. And it turns out that the best series of the year is just kind of like James Harden goes one-on-one and then KD goes one-on-one and James Harden goes one-on-one. And to Jeff's point, he's right that having a guy like who can break down the defense like that and the best part of Jeff's point is it's not just breaking down the defense. It's that Harden is not a good passer, a great passer.
Correct.
And it's not enough to be an okay above average passer. If you're going to be the fulcrum of the offense, you have to be a great passer. And I still think, you know, as hard as it is sometimes to enter the ball to the post, like you have to have guys on your team who can work in the post.
And I would also say this to you, and I believe this wholeheartedly. And the first person who drew my attention to it was Greg Popovich. Like, we cleaned up the perimeter. And therefore, you know, the hand checking, although I do see hand to hand combat in the playoffs, it is a much more physical game. But I do believe that you need to start focusing some on those teams that have back to the basket post players that you legit run your offense through. LaMarcus Aldridge, Joel Embiid, who took more direct post passes than any of center in the league this year and was the most productive scoring center. Like, you know, don't officiate it like it's Shaq in there. Like, I always thought Shaq was so badly officiated because he was such a monster. Like, if we're gonna have some balance in the game and we've got legit post-up options, let's not let people beat on them. If we want to see the beautiful game on the perimeter, then I want to see the beautiful game in the post.
Well, and one of my least I have many least favorite foul types in the NBA. My least favorite is the clothesline in transition, which just is not even a basketball play. And Jeff Van Gundy is on a crusade with
on
me.
It.
And he's correct.
He is correct.
I still think within the next 2 years they're going to penalize that like an off-ball foul.
Yeah,
and
it's going to be a ball. Yeah, that's right. I agree. And they should, Zach, because the reality is with the most spectacular plays in transition, the athleticism, this passing ability that we're seeing, the get by, force a close, lob, boom, on your head. Like, we all want to see that.
Well, go for a steal. How about if it's a real play, fine. You actually tried to get the ball. You didn't just hug somebody like they're your long lost friend.
Right.
The foul type. What was the foul type I was going to say? What were we talking? Oh, when a big guy on a switch posts up a guard and either the guard falls over or the big guy kind of hits him in the chin or throat or chest with his elbow and it's an offensive foul. What? All you're doing is calling a foul because one guy is a foot taller than the other guy.
Right, and that's his arm, his body part ends.
His arm is at that guy's chest. I just don't think – I understand it looks bad. It's a pointed elbow hitting a sensitive area. I just don't know that should be an automatic foul.
Yeah.
Because you're just penalizing – taller people.
All right. Do you think that the Cavs get back in this here? Listen, they're drastic, and this is the other point we were talking about this morning with the players is how different they've looked at home. And there's, you know, whatever the reasons may be, I don't know that there is a legit one. Do you think they have a chance here?
Now, to me, that question is really, do they win both games? Because to get back in the series, I think they have to win both games.
No question. I don't know that. Do they have enough?
I don't think, if you're asking me to predict, I don't think they win both games. I think Golden State gets one of two. I don't know which one. In the end, it doesn't really matter which one. I mean, it matters for the excitement level of game four.
Sure.
But if we get out of here and it's a split, it would take, I think, a shocking turn of events for Golden State not to win the series.
Right.
So I'm going to say no. I do think they have, I think it will be interesting on this level if Cleveland loses game three. I don't think they have an all hands on deck rally for game four like they did last year when they just blew the doors off the Warriors. It doesn't seem like that kind of team. So I have a question for you. We were debating this today and I think it's one of the more interesting debates. There's no way to prove it. Cause I'm thinking a lot about Durant lately. I sat down with Durant for a bit today. I'm probably going to write something on him.
Can't wait to read that.
Well, we'll see. Do you think the Warriors win last year, if it's the Harrison Barnes, Andrew, but whoever, Bogut, Azili, whatever, do you think they win? There was like five of us in the media wait between practices having this debate today.
Man, that is a great question. Kyrie and LeBron, no KD, no. Think about what Kevin Durant did last year.
He's the MVP of the finals.
And, you know, he had upward of 30 every single game, if I'm not mistaken.
Whatever it was a lot.
And it felt,
a lot of points.
And it felt like big shot-making time, Kevin Durant. Like last year, I'm like, man, this dude. Like, I knew he was a great scorer, but I was like, it wasn't just the scoring. Like, you could, and he, you know, he had that thing on the bottom of his shoe to start the year where he put his numbers over the five games. I think the answer to that question might be, I mean, listen, you can't be a revisionist and
no.
And go
I think,
back.
It's an interesting thought exercise.
Certainly, I don't give the Warriors as much of an advantage a year ago without Kevin Durant. He was just too damn good, and by the end they had figured it out, and he had figured it out. And what's fascinating to me about this year is, as I say, the Warriors haven't looked very Warrior-like. I think it's many things, but you think about the times they've had to play without Steph, and then Kevin became the de facto playmaker and was looking very much like the Kevin who had to operate in Oklahoma City at times. And so that give and take for Kevin, whose natural instincts for years in the NBA had been to be that guy, and then to reverse course in the middle of this. So I think that they keep talking about this journey being different, and it's different, and it feels different in every way, and it's a combination of factors. And what's been fascinating to me to watch is Steve Kerr talks often about joy. And the joy of coaching and the joy of playing. this year's been harder for him, a lot harder. And to have to watch him struggle and pull and try to reach this team in different ways, like, that's the human side that is as fascinating to me as the basketball side of this.
You know, it was unanimous among the very small group that I was talking to, not including me, that the Warriors would have won.
Really? Because?
Because the Cavs were so bad defensively, and the Warriors with Harrison Barnes were still an all-time great team. The argument for that is the first two games of the series, which the last three were all close and included the only Cleveland win. The first two, the Warriors won at Oracle by 40, 50, whatever combined, by a lot of points combined. And so you kind of forget those two games because they were so bleh, and the last three were so exciting. But those two games exist. They're on the record, and they feel like games like that might have been a 2-0 series with Harrison Barnes. But that Cleveland team was awesome, and I don't know how I would answer that question. I kind of think they needed Durant to win. My gut is they needed Durant to win.
That's what I think.
Because that Cleveland team was a historically great offensive team. Now, defensively, they went from bad to average, maybe a little bit above average in the playoffs, and they lost one game in the East, and that was enough. Their defense was enough to be that dominant in the East. They were a champ. Let's put it this way. That was a championship caliber team.
Right. And I think this goes to the belief system. Like you said, look, they're not as talented. And LeBron knows they're not as talented. And on top of that, in this series.
They're not good. They're just like not that good of a team.
Correct. But as great as LeBron is, he's smart enough to know I have enough or I don't. And not that that necessarily affects what he tries to do because, you know, as he said, he's going to try to maximize the series for whatever it's worth. And what he told us the first day we sat with him before game one was, I told my guys, let's go play. We're going to play these games. Let's go find out. Like, that's a great way to go in. It's a free way to play basketball. Your mind is not encumbered with a lot of stuff. But what would the belief system have been in the Cavaliers locker room with no Kevin Durant putting 30, 7, and 6 on the board every game?
It's true.
Come on now. That feels different, and they know.
Yeah.
You look competitor eye to eye, I'm going, yeah, I can match up with him. That feels different a year ago. And you can't be revisionist. It's an interesting argument to have, anyway.
You've got to go. There is one question I wanted to ask you about your job. I said that there was a situation that made me vicariously nervous for you, and I forgot about another one that makes me way more vicariously nervous for you.
Okay.
That is coming up soon.
Yeah.
When do you start thinking about the podium? The championship podium. The whole arena is here listening to me podium.
Right, right. First of all, thank you for saying it that way, because that's not the context within which I think about it.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. No, I will, as the series winds to a position of somebody's close to closing, and that's difficult in a seven-game scenario, because then I've got to formulate questions on both ends. But I'll take you through my process. It's somewhat similar, but over a longer span of time. As a game starts to wind down, so I knew I would interview Steph yesterday. So I have a piece of paper that I'm at my broadcast position. It's divided in half, and I'm basically, as the fourth quarter is unfolding, I might be listening something to Jeff or Mark or maybe a stat that Mike has given, and I might write that down because they're intrigued by it, and if they're intrigued, I'm intrigued. Or I might just be watching something and I'm going, okay. So all of a sudden I'm like, boy, he's at 8. Now he's gonna break this record. And I thought, well, boy, this guy's proximity to the game growing up, he did nothing but admire shooters. There's my first question. That's
sure.
Easy. So that's my process in game as I start to get closer. When a series is moving in a certain direction, I've already started to consider some questions. Like I know, and I've been trying to get out in our meetings with these players, give me something about how difficult this job has been for Steve. Like I asked Raymond that today.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've already processed some questions on either side. If LeBron had won game one and I had to be in a position to think, oh shoot, they actually could win this, I would have started to think right then and there, holy
yeah.
This on top of maybe the greatest single postseason run we've ever seen by an individual player, if he ever tops this off with a championship, which I wondered in LeBron's mind, did he think in the fourth quarter of game one, is this my destiny? As much time as I put into my craft, I just put 51, 8, and 8 this is my destiny. Like, I don't know, Zach. This stuff is compelling to
me. I hope so. I hope you thought that, because that would be really cool if you thought that.
Yeah.
It'd be really cool. It was a superhuman performance. And I'm glad we do seem to have reached a point with LeBron where the legacy and narrative, which are two of my least favorite words in sports discourse, that discussion seems to have calmed to the point where everyone is not, they're not going to, people are not going to care if he ends up 3-6 in the finals or whatever it ends up being, or 3-7 or 4-, a losing record in the finals. It does feel like we've reached a point where we're all going to understand it's him and Michael and that's it.
Correct.
And he might end up better no matter what the record in the finals is.
I asked an incorrect question after game 7. In my estimation, I asked, and sometimes I will beat myself up over a question I missed as opposed to one that I asked, but like, I now think there was a very long stretch of time, including up until a point this season, where it felt like every game that guy played was a referendum on his career. I now believe the referendums are over.
It's over.
It's yeah. over. Those referendums are over. There is no questioning. There is no debating. You're right. You're 100%
which
right.
Which is always, you know, and I've made this comparison in columns before, and including before the finals 2 years ago, and Windhorst very smartly wrote it a couple days ago. The Jerry West comparison has always fascinated me. Not because they're equivalent. LeBron is a tier, he's in his own tier with Michael. That's it. But it always drove me a little mad that Jerry West went 1-7 or 1-8 or whatever it was in the finals, lost the finals a million times. And with the distance of time, earned the label Mr. Clutch. Like, we were able to look at the finals record and have enough, like, nuance in our brains to say, yeah, he was 1-whatever in the finals. He's still Mr. Clutch.
Yeah.
I just never understood why in real time we couldn't do that with LeBron. Like, okay, he's whatever and whatever in the finals. Are you not watching him play? Like, are we really holding the record against him? Look at what's happening on the floor.
Because to me, that's the power of narrative. Because narrative just gains momentum, and sometimes it's just, if you're not, like, one of the things I love about you is the amount of preparation that you do for everything you do. Well, it takes that level of preparation to not get swept up in the narrative. It's why, you know, I will reach out to people I trust in the game when it comes time for voting all NBA. I mean, I know what I've seen. There's times down the stretch of the season where I will ask NBA players, hey, can you help me on this one? You're looking opposite these men. You're competing against them every day. I need perspective on this. Like, I like to hear that from the men who are in between
Absolutely.
The lines. Like, that makes a difference to me. Or a coach. You know, I'll call Jeff. I need to know the answer to this question. What are your eyes seeing? Am I missing something here? Because that narrative is a powerful thing, and it's amazing to me how quickly narratives can build and set things in motion that maybe shouldn't happen. Preparation, right? Like,
it's been overblown. You need to go. I've taken up too much of your time, Doris.
No, it's always a blast. Thanks for having me.
There are not many people in the NBA world that it blows me away that I get to have Doris Burke on my podcast. It's just crazy.
Well, so, you're out of your mind. I love your podcast. You're always informative and fun, and I appreciate you having
Congratulations on the new deal. Everyone is thrilled. Congratulations on the Hall of Fame. We will see you at the Quicken Loans Arena tomorrow. Doris Burke, everybody. The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.